Thanks, Sabrina. Thanks for the invitation, and sorry I couldn't be there in person. So today I'm going to tell you about this paper that we put out last year with my student Min Lee. That a bit bigger. So that's the first part of the talk. So that's basically a summary of these asymptotically isometric codes that I'll define and motivate. And then I'll talk about a few new things that are preliminary. That'll be the next part of the talk. Okay, so let me start. Okay, and so the starting point is unfortunately some math. So I just have to get some math things out of the way. Hopefully, maybe you all know this, and that's fine, but I just want to make sure that my jargon doesn't get lost on you. So, the starting point is, okay, let's just think about Hilbert spaces, okay? And we'll think about just finite dimensional Hilbert spaces to begin with. So we just have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and then you imagine what operators can act on that Hilbert space. They're going to be the observables in the quantum mechanical system. And they're just linear operators on that Hilbert space. And in particular, this will define, as we'll talk about later, a von Neumann algebra, which is a type one von Neumann algebra. Now, if we're just working in finite dimensions, it turns out that we have something called norm equivalence. That means that I can sort of talk about, I can compare, say, different operators using some norm. And there's several norms that you can think of. For example, there's the operator norm, which is the sort of most obvious thing, which is just the maximum eigenvalue of the magnitude of the operator, so A dag A. So basically the maximum eigenvalue of A dag A is the operator norm. But I could do other things. I could use the trace. I could, for example, define the one norm as just the trace of this A, this magnitude of A, or there's this norm as well, right? And so it turns out that in finite dimensions, these are all equivalent in the following sense. So imagine I have a sequence of operators and I want to say, oh, that sequence of operators is converging to zero. So what do I mean by that? I have to say, you know, what's converging to zero. So I could have the various norms converging to zero. But it turns out that they're all equivalent because we have this sort of chain of inequalities. So the operator norm A is less than this two norm, which is less than the one norm. And then that's less than the operator norm where I have this factor of the dimension of the Hilbert space, okay? So as long as the dimension is finite, whatever, you know, convergence in any of these norms is equivalent. Now, you know, in physics, we don't really think about, like, we might not always think about things converging to zero. Maybe we're interested in actual errors and we want to quantify the errors. As in, like, for example, how close two density matrices are, it's very natural to use this one norm. We take the difference of the two density matrices and compute the one norm. And often, you know, we might actually care how big the Hilbert space is, and we might say, well, we have some error, two density matrices are close, and we're working with a big Hilbert space. And then we don't get norm equivalence, right? Unless the error is much smaller than one over the dimensions, so I can then use this inequality. But typically that's not the case because the dimension of the Hilbert space is very large. Then we get back to the situation where we don't have norm equivalence. Now, in this talk, I'm gonna sort of exclusively work in infinite dimensions where you never have this norm equivalence. So in that case, instead of talking about linear operators, we talk about bounded operators. These are the operators where the operator norm is less than infinity. And then we can talk about sort of different topologies of operators based on, you know, how we measure how close two operators are. So the standard one is sort of the uniform convergence condition, which is this An goes to A if the operator norm of the difference goes to zero. But then you might do other things. And so it's quite common to have these other topologies. So, they're gonna come up in this talk. So let me define them. So the first one is this strong operator topology, where what I really mean by that is that I define this strong operator limit. So the stronger operator limit of a sequence of operators to A just means that if I fix some state in the Hilbert space, any state in the Hilbert space, and I compute this norm in the Hilbert space, so I act with an minus a on that state, that should go to zero. Okay, and this is similar but different to the weak operator limit, where instead of just fixing one of the states, I fix both states and I compute a matrix element, right? So matrix elements sort of all go to zero. Now, it's important that, you know, when I do this, I fix my matrix elements from the get-go, but they're allowed to be anything. So I fix them, but they're allowed to be anything. And this is what I mean by an goes to a in the weak operator topology. Now, it's not hard to show that this norm or this uniform limit implies the strong operator limit, which implies the weak operator limit, but we don't get the, you know, the other implications. And that's the statement that we don't have normal equivalents. Now, in this context, I can define von Neumann algebras. So let me just do that really quickly. So von Neumann algebras are just a sub-algebra of operators on the Hilbert space. So these are all possible bounded operators on the Hilbert space. You take a sub-algebra that is closed under these limits, right? So if I take take a sequence of operators in my algebra and I take a limit under a certain sense, then I should get another operator in that algebra. In particular, they're closed under either the weak operator topology or the strong operator topology. It doesn't actually matter which one you use, you'll get the same thing. There's another more powerful way of defining what a von Neumann algebra is using this double commutant theorem. So in particular, given such an algebra of operators N, I can always define the commutant as all the operators in the Hilbert space acting on B of H, on H, all of the operators that commute with N, right? That's just the commutant. That's a well-defined thing. And it's an algebra. And in fact, you can show that it's always a von Neumann algebra. And von Neumann algebras have the property that if I take the double commutant, I do that twice, compute the commutant and then compute it again, I should get back to myself. So this is another way of saying, so this is sort of equivalent to this condition, okay? Condition that it's closed under this topology. You can also define this center, which is the intersection of the algebra and the commutant. For me, in this talk, it's always going to be trivial. So the centers will always be trivial. And another way of saying that is the von Neumann algebras that we're talking about are factors. So physically von Neumann algebras are sort of expected to be the right thing. You know, in fact, you know, if you think about in terms of physics, so if you sort of open Hive's book on algebraic quantum field theory, there's some motivations for why you should think about von Neumann algebras. And roughly it's just the statement that it's the observables, the matrix elements that we have control in an experiment. So for example, if I have access to some set of operators, then, and I have access to sort of arbitrary amount of power to do measurements, right? So I have a large number of copies of the system and I can repeat measurements many times, then I can compute matrix elements of these operators. And because I can compute matrix elements of these operators, I can approximate any other operator that may not have been in the algebra, but is in the weak operator closure of that algebra. So that means naturally, even though I may not have started with a von Neumann algebra, by just the nature of the sort of experimental things that I have access to, I will get a von Neumann algebra. Okay. So there's some sort of physical motivation for why we should think about these algebras. As I said before, you know, the classic example, the simplest example of von Neumann algebra is just all the operators acting on a Hilbert space. So that's B of H, that's just defined as B of H. That is a von Neumann algebra. And in fact, it's a type one von Neumann algebra, which is a special class of von Neumann algebras that allow you to do a lot of things. Later, we'll talk about other types that come up. Another thing that's somewhat useful is I'm going to define this notion of a state, which is more from a sort of operator algebra point of view. A state, you know, usually maybe you think of a state as a vector in a Hilbert space, and I'll still call that a state. But also it's common to think of a state as just a linear functional on your observables. So something that takes your observables to numbers, to complex numbers, and satisfies some properties like positivity, a positivity property, and the normalization condition, right? So these would be equivalent to if I had a reduced density matrix on some system, and you know the reduced density matrix is a positive operator, which has trace one. Now, in general, von Neumann algebras, we're not going to have a reduced density matrix, and we're not going to have a trace to define the reduced density matrix or a partial trace. But we will always have these states, right, defined in this sense. Okay, and so there's a special name for these states. They live in something. Well, if they have some nice continuity properties, which you always have to define because you're in infinite dimensions, then there's a name for these, which is the predial. So these states live in something called the predial. Good. Now, you know, why am I telling you about these seemingly technical details? Well, okay, so here's a really quick motivation. I'm not going to go into too much details of this, but I think maybe this is an interesting thing to think more about for this reason. That in quantum gravity, we kind of expect that we should be limited. Our experiments should be limited by the fact that, you know, this finite G Newton effects, this sort of quantum gravity effects. Maybe you can't make measurements to arbitrary precision, for example, in time. And, you know, you can't make arbitrary number of experiments, things like that. So there should be some sort of fundamental limitations for what you can do in a quantum gravity theory. And so, you know, because of that, these issues, like what we mean, what we define by what are the class of observables we have access to, you know, become important, right? And, you know, so that's one way to say it in, say, for example, if we're working in infinite dimensions, but even in finite dimensions, you can see this going to be, you know, it's going to be important to be careful with, you know, what you define as your class of observables, how you take limits in these observables, just by, you know, looking at the dimension of the Hilbert space of a black hole. You know, typically we expect it's like e to the one over G Newton. So unless our errors are really, really small, we'll never have this this sort of norm equivalence, and we'll have to be careful about, you know, what norms we use to define things. So, that's sort of a motivation, but, you know, what I'm going to do is really concretely study these issues in ADS-CFT. So I'm going to, you know, go to really a very precise example of quantum gravity, which is ADS-CFT. So just a really quick summary of that. You know, ADS-CFT is a class of dualities between quantum field theories and quantum gravity theories. So a typical example is Super-Yang-Mills in four dimensions, n equals four Super-Yang-Mills with an SUN gauge group. So that has a duality, which is a string theory in ADS space, in asymptotically ADS space. And so, you know, in all of these examples of ADS-CFT, we always have sort of a family of theories. So a family of quantum field theories, and they're labeled by some number n, and this number is telling you about roughly the number of degrees of freedom in the theory. So in the SUN gauge theory case, it's the size of the representation. That's just the size of the gauge group, and so the size of the matrices. Let's formalize this and say we have a sequence of theories, so CFTs, CFTN. So I'm going to label the sequence of theories by N. This sequence is expected to be dual to some gravitational theory where the important parameter N is then inversely proportional to G Newton. So if N is very large, G Newton is small. And we're thinking about some kind of semi-classical limit in the gravitational theory. And so that's what we're going to focus on here. We're going to think about taking these large N limits very carefully in these theories. So we have this sequence of theories, CFTs. We have a sequence of Hilbert spaces, kappa N. So this kappa N is a Hilbert space. It's, say, infinite dimensional Hilbert space, but it's the Hilbert space that the CFT lives on. Okay, so if you like, let's put the CFT on a cylinder. So this is time. The cylinder I'll call K. And, you know, on that cylinder, we expect there's a Hilbert space. right, which describes all of the correlation functions and everything in the CFT. So that's that Hilbert space I'll call CAP A. Now, you know, I'm going to talk about this in the context of algebraic quantum field theory. So that's the structure here. So I've already motivated von Neumann algebras as the right thing to think about. So how do we think about this sort of ADS CFT in this algebraic quantum field theory language? So let's just think about the CFTs for now. I'm not going to talk about the gravitational theory yet. So for the CFTs, what we say is that to each sort of boundary region O, and I'll take these regions O, so this is O is just a label on boundary regions, I'll take them to be sort of causally complete regions. So they're basically causal diamonds on the boundary cylinder. So you know, I've drawn one here, they're causally complete. So it need not be a diamond, it's just some causally complete region on the boundary cylinder. So that's what O is. And to each of these O's, I'm going to assign a von Neumann algebra. And that's a von Neumann algebra is a subalgebra of all of the possible operators on the Hilbert space, on the CFT Hilbert space. So this is exactly all of the operators that are associated to this region, to this O region, say here. So now in this context, we can also define, given an O, we can define O prime, which is like the commutant that I just defined, but it's a space-time commutant. It's basically all the points on the cylinder that are space-like separated from O. Okay, so in this picture here, it's just this red region that I've drawn on the backside of the cylinder. Those are all the points that are space-like separated to the original region O. So that's important. So we're gonna also, that's also a causally complete region. And so we'll also have an assignment of algebras to that region. Okay, so now in algebraic quantum field theory, you usually assume some nice properties for these algebras, right? So some properties that you expect relate to things like locality and causality. That's what we're gonna do here. So in fact, we're gonna sort of assume all of the reasonable conditions for these theories. So at finite n, this theory is going to have very nice properties, okay? I should say that because I have this family of theories labeled by N, every time you see an N, you should think, oh, that's the boundary theory. That's the boundary theory, which will turn out to be the physical theory in the sense of quantum error correction. So I'll get to that. But every time you see an N, it's like the boundary. It's the boundary theory at fixed N. Okay. So these MN satisfy reasonable conditions. So the first one that's kind of non-trivial, well, okay, this obvious thing is that I'm not gonna write, but basically if I have a causal region and a causal region inside it, then the algebra associated to the inside region should be a subalgebra of the outside region. That's kind of obvious, but that's a condition that you impose. Here's a less trivial condition, which is called Haag duality. So it's the statement that if I think about the algebra of operators associated to the O prime region, so this space-like separated region, then it should be the commutant of the algebra of operators associated to the original region. You just have just causality, microcausality. We'll just tell you that this is a containment. So Mn of O prime is contained in Mn of O prime. But Haag duality is a stronger statement. It's some statement about completeness of the theory. Now, if we just had, you know, a lattice theory or some simple theory where we could take the Hilbert space and tensor factorize it into two regions, A and A bar. So, you know, this is the usual conceit that you think about when you talk about, say, entanglement entropy. You take your region, the cylinder region, you have A, and then you have A bar, and then you think there are local Hilbert spaces, A and A bar. Now, that's not the case because these von Neumann algebras are going to be non-trivial, so you can't actually have that sort of tensor product structure to the Hilbert space. But if we did have that tensor product structure to the Hilbert space, then this would be a trivial state, right? So this is just the algebra of operators associated to A are just bounded operators on this guy. Algebra of operators associated to A bar are bounded operators in this case, and they are commutants of each other. Okay, so it's kind of trivial in the lattice sense. that this is true, but it's some condition we're going to impose here. The other condition we're going to impose is some additivity condition, which is just we're going to use a really weak version of additivity. It's just the statement that if I take my O region and I cover it by little diamonds here, with smaller diamonds. Now, O, remember, need not be a diamond itself. Okay, Sabrina has a question. Do you want to ask?
Yeah, just a quick dumb question, which is how much does it change if the fact that I'm on the cylinder, so it's like a compact time slice versus if it was just two regions in Minkowski suit?
Yeah, good. Yeah, it does change a little bit. So you have to be a bit careful about defining what you mean by high duality when you're not on the cylinder. So for that reason, I'm working on the cylinder. So it's just annoying to me. It's something that algebraic quantum field theory think about all the time. And they always work in Minkowski space and they hardly ever work on the cylinder. And they have to confront that. Yeah, I think for me, the easiest is to work on the cylinder just because you don't get too confused. But it's something you have to think about.
Thanks.
So additivity is the statement that if I take these sort of my causally complete O region, which need not be a diamond, and I cover it by smaller diamonds, then the algebra of O should be just generated locally by the union of all of those operators. This fancy symbol, this V symbol, is called the algebraic union. It's basically what you get by taking the products and sums of all the operators in here and then computing their double commutants. So actually computing the weak or the strong closure of those operators. Okay, so it's a non-trivial thing that you do, it's well defined. And in this case, it defines this additivity property. And then the other thing that we're going to assume, which is true, you can prove it based on other things, but we'll just assume it just for simplicity, is that these algebras are a special type. They're called type 3 von Neumann algebras. The algebras associated to these causally complete regions that are not the cylinder itself, not the entire cylinder. If it was the entire cylinder, that would just be B of kappa n, and that's a type 1 algebra. But for local regions, we have these type 3 algebras. And the type 3 algebra is just, you know, related to the fact that you can't define entanglement entropies for these theories. The entanglement entropy of any state on this type 3 algebra is infinite. That's related to the infinite correlations near the edge of the region. So this type 3-ness is really related to the sort of divergences in entanglement entropy close to the edge of the regions. But it's there. It's also a special factor called this, which is this hyperfinite factor, which means that you can sort of generate it in this sort of algebraic sense of generating just by increasing set of finite dimensional factors. So going to infinity in some way, you can generate that thing. And so that's it's a unique von Neumann algebra that's very special. But we expect that's the von Neumann algebra of local regions in the CFT. So that's this boundary theory CFT. It's fixed n, it's for sort of really well behaved, it has very nice properties. And what we'd like to do now is sort of understand how to take the large n limit, so this semi-classical limit. Now to do that, we have to say what we mean by the infinite n theory. Right? We have to give some meaning to the infinite n theory. And usually this is done using single trace fields. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. We're not going to do any different to what other people have done. So basically we're going to say, okay, there's a special class of operators, these single trace operators, and they have the property that they exist for each of the n theories. So they're sort of a family of fix a single certain single trace field, and then you can find a representative of that field in each n. Okay, and so that's clearly a useful thing for taking the large n limit. Ideally, we'd then like to understand perturbative corrections to this structure. In an algebraic sense, that's a bit complicated. You have to sort of confront some notion of sort of a formal expansion in 1/n. So you introduce some ring over this 1/n parameter. I'm not going to do that today. That's something that's sort of important that we understand how to how to include in the structure. But for now, I'm really just interested in this n equals to infinity theory. And then I guess that structure is important. Like that's the first step in understanding this series expansion, for example. Okay, and so once I have this n equals to infinity theory, I'm basically going to use it to take the large n limit in a certain sense. Okay, so the structure that I'm going to define is basically a structure that allows you to take the large n limit. And it's something that I'm just going to define it for you. I'm just going to give you some ingredients and say this should be true. But it's something that we've basically derived from just thinking about large n correlation functions in a theory like n equals to 4 super young Mills. The derivation is not quite complete. We had to make some assumptions about the convergence of those correlation functions. But I think it's, there's very strong motivations that this is kind of the right structure that you should think about if you want to take the large n limit of these things. Okay, so and it works as follows. It's something that looks a lot like a quantum error correcting code. So that's sort of interesting because it comes out of this derivation. It's a quantum error correcting code where you have some Hilbert space, H, and this Hilbert space is no longer labeled by N. So you should think of that as living in the bulk. It's like the bulk theory, but it's also the infinite N theory. So it's like the infinite. So it's the infinite n theory, n equals to infinite n theory, and it's the theory that the single trace fields act on. So I'll take that in the quantum error correction language to be like the code subspace. So code subspace is this sort of single trace field Hilbert space, and then the physical Hilbert space is going to be this kappa n, the finite n theory. So we have this map Vn, which is an encoding map between the Hilbert space. So encoding map familiar from quantum error correction. And, you know, the interesting thing already at this level is that it's this, you know, we're using the same code subspace for each finite n theory, okay? And so that's weird, it seems a little bit weird, but it's actually, if you think about it, very natural. I think it's like the most natural thing that you can think of where you have this sort of large n theory that, this sort of infinite n theory, and even perturbative corrections, I think, will have this feature. So we have this infinite dimensional Hilbert space. The B of H are the operators that act on it, and they're generated by this single trace field. Now, inside subalgebras of B of H are going to be interesting to us. Okay, and I'm going to associate a specific subalgebra to a boundary region O. So O is the same label that I talked about before. It's a label on the boundary cylinder, right? So on K, there's some O region. And to each of those regions, I'm going to have a von Neumann algebra, C of O, which is a subalgebra of B of H. So it's also generated by single trace fields, but now it's generated locally by the single trace fields. So it's associated to the local regions. And in addition to that, I'm going to have some map that I'll call gamma n, which takes the single trace fields. It respects locality, takes the single trace fields in C of O, and maps it to a specific single trace, a specific operator in the finite n field. Okay, so this does it. So for each n, I have one of these maps. And this is exactly the map that I sort of said in words before. To each single trace field, there's an associated, for a given single trace field, for each n, there's an associated operator in the finite n theory, okay? And that's the thing that allows you to take the large n limit. So this is sort of an important structure. In the quantum error correction language, it'll turn out that this map is just sort of a simple reconstruction map. C of O, as will motivate, will be the causal wedge, will become what's known as the causal wedge, if you know, ADS CFT in that story, that'll be the causal wedge. And this map gamma n you can think of is like a sort of simple extrapolate dictionary. It was generated by the extrapolate dictionary. Okay, so together these three things that I've defined form what we call an asymptotically isometric code. So we have these VNs, we have these subalgebras C of O associated to boundary regions, and we have these reconstruction maps. And together they satisfy properties Again, that we derived from some specific under some assumption that we essentially derived from something like n equals 4 super n mils, they satisfy the following property. So Vn is Vn dagger Vn is an operator. It's a sequence of operators. If I take the limit as n goes to infinity, in this particular sense, this weak operator sense, I should get the identity. Okay, so in quantum error correcting codes, these sort of encoding maps are always isometric encoding maps. So they would just satisfy V dagger V is one. Okay, here we only find it asymptotically. So, and asymptotically in this sort of really weak sense. So in the sense that I should fix my matrix elements, psi and phi, compute it, take the limit, and I'll get the overlap between psi and phi and the limit. Because I get the identity there. So it's sort of weakly isometric. And so, for example, it means we know because we don't have this sort of norm equivalence, it means that Vn dagger Vn minus one, minus one, as an operator norm statement, say, does not go to zero, right? So it doesn't behave like Vn, it doesn't behave like one in that sense. And then the other thing we need are these reconstruction map conditions. So gamma n of c acting on vn is the same as vn times c. So that means that gamma n is sort of representing the operator c on the bulk Hilbert space on V of h. So I'll use the language bulk Hilbert space for h. So gamma n of c is representing that operator in the finite n theory in this limiting sense, right? So I still need to take a limit. So this is the reconstruction condition. If we had exact quantum error correction, there would be no limit here, and you would just have this is equal to the left hand, you know, these two things are equal. But here I need to take a limit, and I take it in this strong operator sense, which I remind you, I fix some state on the bulk Hilbert space, psi, and I compute the norm, and I send that to zero, and I do that for each psi. Okay, so that's what that means. Now this comes out of the structure, but I think it's some physical motivation for this. So the idea is that you want to take your bulk, your operators in the bulk, right? And you want to do some experiments. You want to do some experiments in the quantum gravity theory. So you fix the observables to begin with. And then you're going to compute, you know, some expectation values of those observables or something like that. And then what this structure is telling you is that this code will represent that experiment and that observable for sufficiently small g mu. Okay. It'll give a good approximation to the experiment that you want to do. At sufficiently small g mu. Now, you know, because we fixed the kind of experiment we want to do beforehand, that will mean that there will be some experiments that will do very poorly at any finite g mu, right? So there's going to be some things that will not work very well. And that makes sense because, you know, the bulk Hilbert space we're talking about will be something like quantum field theory on some background. And so in quantum field theory, you have states that say gas of gravitons or something like that, where, you know, if there's too many of those gravitons, they'll collapse and form a black hole, and this code will not be a good approximation to that. However, if I turn off gravity, if I send G Newton to zero at some point, that gas of gravitons will be a good approximation to what's going on. So that's kind of the physical motivation for this. And as I said, it's derived from these sort of single trace fields following this approach, and I should have sort of referenced this paper, which is the starting point for a lot of this considerations, is Liu Leuthauser paper where they talked about taking the large n limit in EDS CFT. And the only thing we're really adding to this is trying to understand how that large n limit then interacts with the finite n theory. Okay. And really trying to build an error correcting code that understands that structure, that large n limit. And Witten also and collaborators has written a bunch of interesting papers along these lines. There's some interesting things that you get, right, that you sort of immediately get. So the first thing is that C of O is like this algebraic quantum field theory net. It's called a net. It's an algebra associated to all boundary regions. But now, if we sort of think about what's going on in ADS-CFT that we know, we have some H is representing some bulk Hilbert space of quantum fluctuations, say on some fixed background. Associated to boundary regions O, there's this bulk region, which is the causal wedge. And I'm going to motivate that C of O is the algebra of operators that's associated to this causal region in the bulk. Okay, so C of O. But now if you think about it from that point of view, there's no particular reason why we should have Haag duality. So Haag duality was, remember, the statement that C of O is equal to C of O prime prime, or this is equivalent to the statement that C of O prime is C of O prime, something like this. We could have this Haag duality violation. And it's quite natural because we know that the causal wedge, in fact, has this property that typically the causal wedge is not, there's this sort of no man's land between the two causal wedges associated to the two boundary regions, O and O prime, and that no man's land is related to this violation of Haag duality. Now, one thing that we do know about C of O is that it should satisfy this additivity property. It should be additively generated. And you can see that basically from the derivation. It's also an assumption about the code. And what that means is if I take sort of causal boundary diamonds near the boundary, and I think about all the operators that that generates, then it turns out that, if you think about it from the bulk quantum field theory point of view, all of those operators near the boundary actually will generate the entire causal wedge. Now, the causal wedge has a specific definition. It's the future and past of the boundary region O, the intersection of the future and past of the boundary region O in the bulk. So that's some causal region. It turns out that that causal region is not causally complete. However, you can causally complete it. It's a slightly bigger region once you causally complete it. And the idea is that C of O is actually that causal completion. The way really to understand this is still a non-trivial statement, but the way really to understand this is often thought of in terms of HKLL, but really the modern way to think about it is something called the time-like tube theorem, which is the theorem that says that if I do talk about all the operators near the boundary, they will actually generate all of the operators in the causal wedge like this. Now, one thing that's sort of trivial and important to recognize is that because I'm talking about the bulk Hilbert space H, when I compute commutators in this algebra, it's actually with respect to the bulk Hilbert space. So that means that my von Neumann algebra closures and things like that are constrained by the bulk Hilbert space, which means that I'm going to be constrained by causality in the bulk. So that also motivates why we should get the causal wedge here. Now, then you might ask, how do I think about the entanglement wedge, right? So the entanglement wedge is the region associated to a boundary region related to the root Takinagi surface. So you find that, if given a boundary region O, you find the RT surface, and then the entanglement wedge is sort of all of the operators in between the RT surface and the boundary, and then it's the causal completion of that. So I'm not drawing time in this picture, this is just a time slice, but if you to sort of compute the domain of dependence of this, then you'll get the entanglement wedge. That's not the same as the causal wedge. In general, the entanglement wedge is bigger than the causal wedge. So how do we understand this in terms of the codes and the structure that I just defined? The idea is that the way that I think about the entanglement wedge is as an extension of the causal wedge. So basically, we have our causal wedges, which I've drawn here. This is one causal wedge. And we're asking, this is a causal wedge here. We're asking, can we extend the causal wedge into this no man's land? Okay, and when I say extend, I need to give, you know, a definition of what it means to do that. It means in this sort of quantum error correction language that you can find reconstruction maps beta n that act like the simple reconstruction gamma n. But they basically take the bulk entanglement wedge to the boundary region, respecting the sort of causal structure of the boundary regions O. So these are both pertaining to O. So beta n does this map, and it satisfies the reconstruction condition, right? So beta n acting in the physical theory represents the bulk code subspace operator n, little n. And this is true for all possible operators in the entanglement wedge. So in this epsilon of O, so this epsilon of O is an extension of the causal wedge. And sort of entanglement wedges are when you have maximal extensions. So I'll talk about that in a bit. But you know, this is just some small extension into this region here. So now, given this extension, we'd like to sort of understand properties of this extension. And so we proved a theorem just based on the structure that I wrote down, this asymptotically isometric code, which gives you strong constraints on the possible extensions. Now, it's important, and this is often confused when I gave this talk, that you know this extension need not exist. Okay, so we may not be able to extend the causal wedge at all. So it might be that's it, right? We're done. There's no man's land. We can't extend it in any way. So this theorem pertains to an assumed extension. Okay, so I'm going to assume there's an extension, and then I'm going to say some properties of that extension. So the first thing is, if there is an extension, it has to satisfy boundary causality. So for example, here's an extension of O, but then I could have also talked about the extension of O prime, and something like this is not allowed where the two extensions overlap. So if the two extensions overlap, that's inconsistent with boundary causality for various reasons. This theorem is a version of something called information disturbance trade-off theorem. And really at its heart, it's a version of really no cloning. It's a no cloning statement. If I did have an overlap like this, I could put some quantum information in between the two overlap regions. I could reconstruct it both on O and on O prime, and that would violate no cloning. Okay, so this is not allowed. Now, this is not allowed, but it's also this is a non-trivial proof. Like this theorem is quite a non-trivial thing to prove. And then so another way of saying this is the following: E of O, any extension must be contained in E of O prime prime. This is just this causality statement that you expect, sometimes called Einstein causality, and it's a basic assumption that you impose on algebraic quantum field theory algebras. Here we're just sort of deriving it. Okay, that's fine. So you can prove that. The next theorem that we prove pertains to a maximal extension. So a maximal extension is one that satisfies this. So that means basically I take my two causal wedges and I can extend up to a point, so up to some common line here from O and also from O prime in the opposite direction. Okay, so that's a maximal extension, and it's quite, you know, it's reasonable to define an entanglement wedge or you know, the root Takinagi surface or something like that in this algebraic language as things that satisfy how duality have this maximal extension. So this I'm actually just going to define as an entanglement wedge. It's something that satisfies how duality. Okay, so this theorem pertains to such an extension. Now, again, I remind you, such an extension need not exist. I'm assuming that it exists. And what this theorem says is that if it exists, that's statement one, and that is equivalent to statement two, right? So one implies two, and actually two implies one. So you know, if we had property two, which I'll say what it is in a second, if we had property two, then that would imply the existence of entanglement. Okay, so property two is a form of the JLMS statement Jeffero's Lefkowitz Moldacena Su, which is the sort of equality of relative entropy between the bulk and the boundary. So relative entropy is some quantity that compares two different states in a quantum information sense. So it takes two different states and gives you a number with nice properties. And so so condition two is a statement that if I have any two bulk states on the code subspace, I pass them through the code. At the adjoint action of Vn just basically takes the bulk code as state and makes it a boundary state for each n. If I take those states, I reduce them to the boundary region Mn of O, and I compute their relative entropy, and then I take the limit as n goes to infinity, I should get the bulk relative entropy. Okay, so this is the version of equality of between the bulk and the boundary relative entropy, but it's in this limiting sense. So this sort of asymptotic equality of bulk, of the bulk relative entropy with the boundary relative entropy. So if that was true for all states, then you've shown that there's an entanglement wedge. Or conversely, if you have an entanglement wedge, then you know that's true for all states. Okay. So that was sort of a summary of these asymptotically isometric codes and what we've sort of done so far. And now I want to say a few new things. So the first new thing is there's a version of this sort of, there's another condition that gives you the existence of an entanglement wedge, which is related to something called modular flow. And it connects to a paper that I wrote some time ago with Ito Lefkowitz, where we showed how to do bulk reconstruction using modular flow. Now, there's always been this sort of bulk version of modular flow version of bulk reconstruction using modular flow, but it's sort of not obviously how it connects with the quantum error correction story of bulk reconstruction. So that was another story. And so there was always a question about how these two things are related. And it turns out that in these codes, you can prove that they're the same thing. You do so as follows. So I should say that, the quantum error correction reconstruction is the thing that I've been talking about. Now I'm going to show that's equivalent to this modular flow reconstruction. So it relies on a property that is true, that's sort of typically true in quantum field theory. So it's something that's quite reasonable to assume. And the property is that the states in the bulk, so I'm talking about bulk quantum field theory here, there's a special state in the bulk, which is jointly cyclic and separating for the two regions, the causal wedge and the entanglement wedge. So cyclic and separating is just some property of the states, which relates to basically, conditions that the state is very entangled between the algebra and its commutants. So there's a lot of entanglement between the algebra and the commutants. And then if that's true, you get the cyclic and separating states. So technically it just means that C acting on the state eta generates the full Hilbert space. That's the cyclic condition. Separating condition says that if C acting on eta vanishes, then you can tell that C is zero. Okay, so so if that's true for both C of O and E of O, then what I'm going to tell you is true. So the third condition in this sort of theorem two is the following. You have a sort of asymptotic equivalence between modular flow acting on the sort of causal wedge operators and the bulk modular flow. So this is boundary modular flow, this is bulk modular flow. So what is modular flow? Let me just give a really quick explanation for that. So basically in the boundary modular flow, if I had type one algebras, which I don't, but if I did, then I would have density matrices, and modular flow is just the dumb thing of conjugating an operator by the density matrix reaches the power is. So basically it's like a version of Hamiltonian flow where you use the density matrix, a log of the density matrix is the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is the statement that I have modular flow in the bulk equally modular flow in the boundary, but it's only modular flow in the bulk acting on the sort of causal wedge reconstruction operators. And so if I have that equality, then you can prove that there's an entanglement. Okay, so that's the statement. And basically the proof uses some nice properties that that comes from this joint cyclic and separating condition, which says that if I basically take bulk modular flow, act on the causal wedge, which remember is a subalgebra of the entanglement wedge, that flow will generate all of the entanglement. Okay, so basically I start with an operator here in the causal wedge and I flow, I get another operator that comes out here. That's always going to be true. The non-trivial thing is that you get all possible operators doing that. So this is a kind of operator or ergodicity. And to do it, you definitely need to have infinite dimensions. You can't do it in finite dimensions. So infinite dimensions, you are required to have this kind of ergodicity and to prove this statement. Yeah, okay, good. So that's true. There's some relation to the time-like shoot theorem, but I'm going to skip that. Okay, so that's the first new result. So this sort of equivalence of different reconstruction statements. The quantum error correction reconstruction is the one that I defined, and then its equivalent is modular flow reconstruction. And I should have said, I forgot to say that, you know, Aitor and I, we sort of didn't prove that you could do reconstruction. We just sort of suggested it based on this idea of mixing operators, taking operators in the causal wedge and mixing them into the entanglement wedge using modular flow. But we didn't know how to prove that you could get every operator using that. Here, we can prove it using this nice joint cyclic and separating state. And that's something that maybe, you know, we would have got stuck on before, because maybe we weren't thinking in infinite dimensions. But now we can do it. Okay, so now I want to say a few more things that are new. So I want to tell you something a little bit about the vacuum codes. So this again is still preliminary, but basically, you know, when I say a vacuum code, I mean something pretty specific. So let me sort of back up and tell you what I would mean by that. So in these error correcting codes, to really define the code, you have to have, you know, you sort of basically need a sequence of states, and the code is based on that sequence of states. Now, using that sequence of states, you can get many other states by acting with operators, so it's not just limited to those states, but you're not going to get all possible states in the, say, finite, in ADS-CFT, right? So for example, our sequence of states might be the sequence of thermal states, or a sequence of thermofield double states. And then using these codes, we might get a black hole background or something like that. Or if we're below the Hawking page transition, we won't get a black hole background. Another natural sequence of states is just the sequence of vacuum states. And so based on that, you're going to get some code. Now, how does that really fit into all of ADS-CFT? So let me give some cartoon of how I expect this should work. So in ADS-CFT, we're talking about sort of asymptotically ADS solutions. So imagine we have some solution to Einstein's equations or whatever that's asymptotically ADS. Then that will define, you know, classically, at least, the phase space of the theory. Right? So I can, in ADS-CFT, in the classical sort of the classical limit, I'll have sort of a point in this phase space for each solution. And what we're doing with these asymptotic codes, and what sort of Louis Leutheiser and Witten et al. Are doing, are sort of fixing a background and talking about small fluctuations on top of that background. Now, the small fluctuations will include gravitons. You can do better by including perturbative 1/n correction, something that we haven't done. But if you did that, you would do a little bit better. But you wouldn't be able to describe things that were far off in phase space, if you like. So if there's another completely different solution, then you wouldn't be able to describe that solution. You're just sort of limited to fluctuations around some point. So here's a cartoon of the phase space here, where sort of we have some fixed geometry, small fluctuations about that geometry, exploring sort of some neighborhood of that phase space. And then there's some nonlinear interaction, say in the theory, in the gravitational theory. And we're basically just sending those to zero, because we're sending G Newton to zero. We're holding H bar fixed, so we have quantum mechanics. So we have small fluctuations around that point, which is related to quantum mechanics, sort of quantizing this phase space in that neighborhood. But ultimately, we would like to have some super code where we have, to each of these points in phase space, we have some code some asymptotically asymmetric code, and there's some patching of these things together. Maybe there's some bundle structure over the phase space or something. So then we would have these asymptotically isometric maps for each of the points PI. Now it's sort of an open question, how do we patch all of this together? And it's related to this question of one over n corrections. I'm not going to do that now. This is just some motivation. This is something to think about. What I'm going to do now is just pick a point and study that. So the point I'm going to pick is vacuum ABS. So I'm going to try to make some non-trivial statements about asymptotically isometric codes based around the vacuum. Okay, so as I said, that means we have a sequence of states, in this case, the vacuum states of the CFD, and they're represented on the code. So that means that there's a state in the bulk Hilbert space that I'll call eta, that if I map through Vn, I get the vacuum code of each n. Now I can do this, I could imagine that this should be an exact statement, Vn acting on eta giving me the vacuum code exactly, but actually you can prove all of the statements that I'm going to prove if this is just true in a limiting sense. So these things as a sort of like this is in the Hilbert space norm, if that goes to zero. Then I say that the sequence is represented on the code. And then if this sequence is represented on the code, we can say some non-trivial things. So the first thing is, you know, I'm going to assume that kappa n, of course, you know, this is a CFT, so there's some unitary representation of the conformal group, so D2. UN acts on that Hilbert space, and it sort of acts covariantly on these boundary elements. And it satisfies the spectrum condition. There's just some nice things that it satisfies. This is part of the assumptions, the finite n assumptions, where you make all the nice assumptions about finite n theory. Okay, and now in that context, so vacuum code, I have the vacuum representation of the conformal group. I have the representation of the conformal group. Then you can prove the following theorem, which is the equivalence of the following statements. So the first statement, again, you know, the first statement is that the entanglement wedge of a causal diamond on the boundary, so this is just a specific, it's the intersection of the past and future of two points that are time-like separated, you get a causal diamond. Then, condition one is that the entanglement wedge of the causal diamond is the same as the causal wedge of the causal diamond. Okay, so this is something we expect is true for, you know, a vacuum ADS CFD. If you look at the causal wedge of a causal diamond, it's the same as the entanglement. Okay, but that's condition one. And so condition two is that the Hilbert space, the bulk Hilbert space, furnishes a unitary representation of the conformal group. Okay, so I didn't assume that to begin with, but if you assume that, it's a reasonable thing. And in fact, this conformal group acts covariantly through the code. So if I act with un of vn, then I get the same thing as vn u of g. Okay. So if this is the case, which is that's something you maybe want to put into the code from the get-go, then you can use this theorem to prove the entanglement wedge of a causal diamond is the same as the causal wedge of a boundary diamond is the same as a causal wedge. Okay. So a theme of the next couple of slides, I'm going to finish soon. Is basically rederiving things that we know are sort of true based on general ADS CFT lore. But the new thing here is we're going to prove them rigorously. Okay, so this you can prove rigorously. Okay, so there's some basic reason how you can prove this. It basically uses some old results in algebraic quantum field theory, and a simple statement about why it maybe works is that the conformal boosts of a diamond in vacuum are the same as the modular flow, this modular flow structure for the vacuum state. So you basically get the conformal group out of the modular flow structure. This statement gives you the modular flow structure, and then you can prove the existence of the conformal group and vice versa. Okay, good. So this result is a form of bulk reconstruction. We've sort of reconstructed the isometries of ADS based on some other things that, you know, we expect are true. It's the quality of entanglement wedge and the causal wedge. Okay, but maybe that's a little bit trivial. In, you know, the entanglement wedge is trivial in that case. Can we say something about a more non-trivial entanglement wedge? So yes, we can. So we have the following theorem. So the theorem takes as input something about the partition function of the theory. So if I compute the partition function of the theory on the sphere at finite n, that's this guy, and I take the limit as n goes to infinity, if that is finite and equal to the partition function of the bulk theory, then we have the following statements. Now, this condition is true in ADS-CFT below the Hawking-Page transition. So for temperatures below the Hawking-Page transition, now the confusing thing about this theorem is it still pertains to the vacuum of ADS. So I haven't, even though there's a temperature here, I'm not going to say anything about the thermal state. I'm going to say things about the vacuum state, but I'm going to use this as input, right? So if this is true, then you can prove the entanglement wedge of two boundary diamonds that are causally, so that are disjoint from each other, is equal to just the causal wedge of the two diamonds. It's just generated by the causal wedges of the two diamonds. As long as the distance between the two diamonds is sufficiently large. And what I mean by sufficiently large is set by this Hawking-Page temperature, okay? So again, still vacuum code, but you can use the Hawking-Page, the finiteness of the partition function below the Hawking-Page temperature to prove the entanglement wedges are locally generated. Okay, all right, good, almost done. And so that's one thing you can prove. You can also prove that the bulk satisfies the split property. So the split property is basically some statement about the algebras of these two regions. So the cause, in this case, I'm talking about the causal wedges of the bulk regions. So I have two causal wedges, C1, C2. The split property is the statement that there's a state in the bulk Hilbert space that looks like a factorized state between the two regions. This is something that you always have in finite dimensions. You just take the product of two different density matrices in the two different regions. But in infinite dimensions, it's actually non-trivial. And you can see that by taking C1 to be equal to the commutant of C2, in which case, you know, these are type 3 monomial algebras, and this is just not true. So the split property has to break down at some point. But, you know, we can prove that the split property is true in the bulk as long as the distances are large enough apart, given set by, again, by this Hawking-Page result. And then finally, you can use this to prove that the limit of the bulk mutual information, of the boundary mutual information, is equal to the bulk mutual. Something, you know, again, we expect is true by sort of Ryutaki Nagi. Okay, so let me finish with just a real quick sort of expectation of what's going on here. If you let me have a couple more minutes. I'm gonna take it, sorry. This is the last slide. Okay, so I think this is interesting. This result is really interesting. So basically it's going to allow us to, in general, these codes are going to allow us to say whether the bulk theory is a string theory or not. So it's going to say, it's going to be cognizant of whether the bulk theory is a string theory or not. And so it's going to tell us about bulk locality, right? So in the code itself is some structure that says, oh, this theory has sub ADS locality or not, right? And what is the scale of that locality? And so that goes as follows. So if I take two boundary regions and I think about their causal wedges, right? I can ask, where is the split property true? So this statement that I have this factorized state. Now it turns out that the split property, I'm always assuming this true on the boundary theory. So at finite n, it's just by assumption, just because I want the theory to be nice, it's just true. And I think it should be true based on what we know about n equals 4 superior nulls, it should just be true. Now in the bulk, we may not have the split property. And in fact, there's some suggestion that the split property will fail at some scale when these causal wedges are within the string length of each other. And the reason for that is you have a Hagedorn divergence in the bulk. Once you have a Hagedorn divergence in the bulk, it's reasonable that you don't have the split property. In fact, there's no proof there. It's just the statement that if you don't have a Hagedorn divergence, then you can prove the split. So we want the converse of that, which we don't have, but I think it's quite suggestive. there's a scale at which the mutual information has this phase transition. That's where the limit on the mutual informations is finite beyond that. And then there's this other scale, which is related to 1/Hawking-Page temperature, which is where we can prove that the mutual information is finite in all that makes sense. And so, you know, there's this gap here where we haven't proven anything, but, you know, we believe that the mutual information, or obviously we expect by ADS-CFT mutual information is finite. There's a gap where we can't prove it, but yeah, that's what we can do. Okay, so that's the end. That's all I have to say. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Okay, so let's open the floor to questions. Mm-hmm. If you guys don't ask questions, I'm going to ask ChatGPT to ask questions. So please ask a question.
Did you record it so you can ask?
No, I tried to. Sorry, you saw me actually playing with that.
Some input.
So I know. So what I did is I just copied your intro and discussion session from your paper. So it's going to be a bit off, but I have. You saw me continue trying to get the transcript. It just doesn't let me get it live.
Oh, that's what happened.
Yeah, sorry about that. I thought it wouldn't be showing.
Rob. That's cool. I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, I'll show you what it tries. It's gonna be bad, but go first, Rob.
Okay. I'm intrigued to hear what ChatGPT wants to know, but just to clarify, originally when you were talking about this separation, I thought you were talking about boundary stuff, but you're actually talking about separations in the bulk. Is that the
D's? Yes and no. So I mean, basically it's the same, basically because we're in a vacuum code. There's a boundary theory sort of expression for this D here. But it turns out to be just a distance. It's literally the distance between the two bulk regions. The thing that tells you where all of these things are happening is just related to the distance between these two bulk regions, but that's related to conformal symmetry. So there's a boundary calculation where you get that distance.
Okay. Yeah. And you were focused on the n goes to infinity limit, but I'm just wondering, you know, what do I learn, for instance, about the Ru Takayanagi surface at finite n, or have I learned something from this approach?
It's a good question. You know, the way that I'm defining things, it's almost like I would say it doesn't exist at finite n. So really, you have to talk about limits. I mean, there's a sense in which I think that could be true. I mean, in the sense that even if you know, we could make statements to all orders in 1/n, which some people believe we can, then you still have non-perturbative things, and so if you want a really rigorous definition at finite n, it just may not exist. That's maybe a bit pessimistic. It's consistent with what I'm saying, but I'm not saying that that's necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. And one last one. I was intrigued by the idea that you could do different extensions. It wasn't just the causal wedge and the entanglement wedge. And I'm just wondering, there are these ideas that you may have an extremal, but like the Python's lunch ideas, you may have but non-minimal surface. And can you see something about the complexity of the mapping changing or something like that in with different kinds of extensions?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think like that kind of structure, if we can understand it in our code, would be an example where you can't do this entanglement wedge extension, just because typically you'll have states that have different entanglement wedges. So you have to talk about state-specific entanglement wedges, which is a little bit different. And I don't exactly know how to talk about it in these codes, but in terms of complexity, I don't know what the signature of complexity is here. There is some notion of like somehow the operators that have the larger limit are simple operators. You know, they're the causal wedge operators. Mm-hmm. And even in the entanglement wedge, the things that you're getting are those operators. They're simple for some boundary region. There might be, you know, it's something about the large end limit. You know, it's sort of like the stuff that doesn't behave well under the large end limit is maybe the complex stuff, right?
So right.
But I don't know. Yeah. It's not very precise. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. That was a great talk. Sure.